Thank the bank for this opportunity to study. I thought maybe for Adar, approaching Purim, we could look at the question of reality and illusion. You know, Purim is the time of masks and hiddenness, right? Esther means the one who's hidden. Purim, the significance of Purim is that it signifies the transition in Jewish history from a time when things are revealed to a time when things are hidden. Right? If you make a span of Jewish history, if this is 6,000 years, yeah? Right? The Gemara says the world will last for 6,000 years. And that's a creation, and that's Mashiach. And we are about, about here. We're about up to you. Because we're 5774, that's the proportions. If you go back from where we are, about 2,350 years, you get to Purim. And Purim is the time when what's called Gilui Panim, when Hashem, God, revealed himself in the world, ended and he began to hide himself in the world. Up till there, you had prophecy, people speaking openly, receiving direct communication. You had miracles taking place, open miracles. The Rambam says that no miracle had ever occurred in Tanakh without the presence of a prophet. The two are needed. One, you need the prophet to be the medium for the miracle to occur. And when prophecy ended, then miracles ended. And from then on, we live in what's called Hestoponim, the generations of darkness. It's very easy, it's very clear to see that. You see that separated by 200 years, you have Purim and then Hanukkah. Purim is the end of the biblical phase when things are revealed, and you see it's a transition. On the one hand, it's a book of the Bible. On the other hand, it doesn't mention God's name. On the one hand, it talks about miracles like all the previous books of the Bible, but they're hidden. It's a hidden miracle, not a revealed one. There's no sea splitting, dead people being revived. All it is king couldn't sleep, happened to be exactly on the same night, time and arise. That's a series of coincidences which lead miraculously from the Jewish people's destruction to their redemption, but in no way that is visible. The word Purim means the luck of the draw. It's not even a Hebrew word. It means a lottery, right? One thing after another, you see that Purim is a time of incipient hiddenness. The word Megillah actually means a rolled up scroll, and it also means Megale, to reveal. There's both of those. And then 200 years later, you have Hanukkah, and there's nothing revealed at all. Hanukkah, there's nothing, it's not even a Mishnah. Nothing written about Hanukkah, nothing. Hanukkah has no miracle at all. The only miracle of Hanukkah is the 8 days of flame burning, which is a very, very much more similar to the miracles that you have in the Gemara later, where there's no significance to the miracle. It happened after the war. It had nothing to do with saving the Jewish people. Only the Kohanim saw it. It was a private thing inside the temple. It's nothing like the miracles that saved the Jewish people before. It's just a last wave goodbye, if you like, from the world of the miraculous. So the thing to grasp about Purim, the fundamental thing to grasp about Purim, is that it's a transition from a revealed world to a hidden world. In Torah terms, we say it's a transition from the written law to the oral law. The Torah that's written, Torah Shebiksav, which is dictated prophetically, where God is speaking, to the time when man begins to speak in Torah. The oral law is where with the creativity of rabbinic thought and where analysis of the Mishnah, that is the transition from the revealed to the hidden world. And therefore, the fundamental thing to study here is how we lose sight of reality. Right? If you want to take for those who insist on taking a message home, you know, something you can do about it, not just understanding Torah, as if that's not enough, then the message you can take out of this is the Musa here is our tendency, the curse that we live under, which is the losing contact with reality and building worlds of illusion. We choose to wear the mask, and so we don't see things clearly, right? I know bankers are different, they always see things clearly. They see things in the present, they see what's coming. If you're a banker, you don't need this tool. But if you're a mere mortal, then you tend to have the problem of building worlds of illusion. So let's see if we can try to study that phenomenon and understand a bit more about this mysterious hiddenness that Purim introduces, because that's really our problem. So if you go back and trace the history of this, right, the history of the fact that man is put into the world with clarity. He's put into a world of reality, sees things as they are. He has to see things there as they are. Because the clarity of existence forces itself on him. And then man insists on bringing into existence a dimension of unreality, of non-existence. Right? And that dimension of non-existence is actually called death. And that's what needs to be corrected. Let's try to think through this. So we want to announce Mr. Didier Essemini for the successor of Yedidia Ben Daniel Gwila Chaya, Mr. Lishov Figdor for his sister Matya Moshe, birth of a baby, and anonymous Dove. Our thanks to those people for this year. So, I'm sure you can bring in a chair from... That's the problem. The problem is that, you know, instead of seeing the world as it is, we see the world through our eyes. That means we're right. And if anything is out of line, everyone, you know, it's like from the sublime to the ridiculous. It's the mother who phones her son. She says, "Oscar, are you driving on the M1? So Oscar says, "Yes." She says, "Listen, be extremely careful. I heard on the radio that there's some crazy guy going the wrong way." He said, "Mom, there's hundreds of them." It's hard to drive your mother crazy, right? Because I'm right. If something doesn't fit, it's everybody else, right? My rules are the rules. South Africa, there's a joke in South Africa about this. You have to know South African culture, but you know, every country has its archetypal idiot. Or in every country they have another one that they tell jokes about. In South Africa, there's a fellow who's that kind of guy. So he's driving with his friend in the car, and they come to a red light, and he speeds right through the red light. So his friend says to him, "What are you doing?" He said, "You'll kill us." He says, "No, my brother always does it." Next red light, he goes accelerates straight through the red light. He says, "No, it's okay, my brother always does this." Third red light, even faster, right through the red light. He said, "What are you doing?" He says, "No, my brother always does this." Next light's green, screeches to a halt. The fellow says, "What are you doing?" He says, "No, in case my brother's coming through." You know, so in Ada you can do this. So the question is, whose rules and who's right? And that's the problem. So let's trace it. Let's go back. You go back to the beginning of this, you have the human condition. Man is created in a garden, which is a zone of reality. You know, when you're 6 years old, you read that man and woman, they find themselves in a garden, they're surrounded by trees. But obviously, we're talking something much more sophisticated. The word etz in Hebrew, which means a tree, the root, that word in Hebrew, etz, means a thing of intrinsic essential existence. The word etzem in Hebrew means something that is actual. The bone, the skeleton of the thing is called etzem. And etz is something that is, you're talking about human beings put into a dimension of reality. The fact that they happen to be trees in the physical sense is secondary. Right? They were put into a garden where they were surrounded by objects, by phenomena, entities that are real. And their work was to engage those. You know, the Torah says, Hashem said to man, "Of all the trees in the garden you may eat." Mikol etz hagan ochel. The simple translation is, you may eat these trees, fruit, but this one you may not eat. The Kabbalists interpreted, translated literally. It means, of all the trees of the garden you must eat, but this one you may not. Your work is to engage every aspect of reality and absorb it and elevate it. That's your work. Eating always means... eating. Eating is engaging the world and absorbing that aspect of the world into the self in a way that keeps soul in body. That's what eating is. The sacrifices in the temple are the mechanism by which the world keeps the divine presence in the world. That's why all the laws of the sacrifices are laws of eating. The altar is called Hashem's table, Shulchan Gavoya. All the sacrifices are done with all the laws of meals, with the water and the salt. Right? It's Korbani Lachmi. It's called his bread. So, eating is an essential exercise of keeping soul in body and thereby elevating it. In Hasidus is a very powerful idea that you can only eat meat if you have a spiritual quality. Because to kill an animal and eat it is a very brutal thing. Very, very unideal thing. The original world was vegetarian. But if that animal dies and its essence is absorbed into you and something positive happens with it, it's a different thing. That's an elevation. And the animal has absorbed the plant world and the plant world has absorbed the inanimate world. So you elevate the whole process. So to eat the fruits of the garden doesn't mean you give permission. It means your work here is to absorb every aspect of reality and incorporate it into yourself. You are the microcosm, central focus of the universe. You absorb all of that. And there's one tree you cannot eat. And what, understand this well, what is the fruit, what is the tree that he cannot eat? the fruit of that tree is the fruit of confusion. You eat the fruit of that tree, what you introduce into the world is a world of, is a dimension of inability to see reality. You know, people have such a superficial view, they think it was the tree of evil. The tree of evil, you eat the fruit of the tree, evil enters the world. But it's not called the tree of evil. It's called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. If it was a tree of pure evil, no one would go near it. It would smell so bad, nobody would be able to engage it. But it's the tree of confusion. You know that the language in the Torah is Eitz Hada'as Tovera, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Knowledge always means marital intimacy. That's its original meaning in Torah. Da'as means to know a thing. It means the thing becomes part of the mind, that one is absorbed in the other. Right? That's knowledge. This is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That means where good and evil become so enmeshed they cannot be disentangled. When you eat the fruit of that tree, you don't become bad, you become confused. In Kabbalistic translation, that tree is called Ilana Desfeka, the tree of doubt. The function, when a person eats the fruit of that tree, they become bad, he becomes confused. You see immediately when Adam eats the fruit of the tree, what happens to him? He starts hiding under the foliage in the garden from the one whom he knows sees through the trees. He knows God sees through the trees. He spoke to him a minute before. He was on a cosmic level. Now he's imagining that he can hide under the trees as if God can't see him. And the greater tragedy, of course, is that the most important and pervasive midah in the world is midah keneged midah. God always operates the way you operate. Hashem Tzilcha is your shadow on your right hand, and you determine the way the shadow moves. So that the way you function is the way he functions. So man hides under the trees as if God can't see him, and God arrives in the garden and says, Ayaka, where are you? You want to set up the rules as if I can't see where I am. So man schleps himself out from under the trees and he says, here I am. And God says to him, did you eat from the tree? Hamin ha'etz? Did you eat? I don't know. You tell me. And the word hamin, says the Gemara, is haman. And here Purim is born. Because when God asks the question, that means I don't see you. You live now in a world where I'm blind. You can get away with anything you like. I don't see you. Haman is born. Haman is the scion of Amalek. By the way, Amalek has the same gematria as the word Safek, which means a doubt. Amalek is the nation that introduces doubt to the world. God, where? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe yes, maybe not. The Jewish people are witnesses to God's existence. Amalek says, maybe not. They represent the gap. We represent imminence in the world, and they represent the gap. Amalek is gematria Safek. And that's where Amalek comes into existence. Haman is born in the question of Hamin Ha'etz. Did you eat from the fruit of the tree? Did you pervert the meaning of trees, which means attachment to essence and reality, objectivity in the world? And and from that time on, man cannot see clearly. He's now introduced, he's given reality to the dimension of imagination, and instead of seeing things as they are, he sees things, the projected, fallen version of his own imagination. There's so many consequences. I mean, one consequence is that he now absorbs the world in its real and unreal state. What happens is you live in the world, you absorb the part that is good, the part that is bad. Together they look delicious, of course. They look wholesome. But now you cannot absorb only the good. Right? Just to take one aspect of this in the body. Now man is a creature who eats food that contains the good and the bad. So it looks delicious together. But when the body absorbs what is needed, what's left is tremendously offensive. Tremendously offensive. Extremely humiliating. So human beings walk around with all their dignity, containing excrement. Extremely humiliating. It wasn't the human situation. Before the sin, there was no excretion. The Gemara says that when they reached that level in the desert, after the giving of the Torah, their bodies absorbed the food. They ate manna. The manna was crystallized Shekhinah, divine presence crystallized. When you absorb that, there's no excretion. Right? So now they descend into a world where the work is to separate between the nutritious and the disgusting. By the way, you see so clearly, they go through the desert. Who's their spiritual nemesis in that? These are people who are living on a level where they're absorbing food, means absorbing the material of the world in total perfection and purity. And who's their nemesis? Is a sect called Baal Peor. And they worship excretion. What's going on? You're talking about people in a generation great enough to relate to giving of the Torah when God appears in the world. These people worship excretion. Moshe Rabbeinu Moses, the king of reality, who sees totally clearly through a lens that is completely clear, he's buried opposite Baal Peor. Baal Peor is the cult that worships excretion, and the counterpart to that is Moses, the one who sees clearly. Right? You know that the Gemara says They worshipped excretion. The way they served their god was they had the idol. They used to perform their bodily functions in front of the idol. That was the worship. I can say there was one woman who served every idol in the world. She had been through every idolatry. You can imagine the extremes of illicit and depraved behavior she'd experienced. When she found this, she thought it was so ridiculous and disgusting. To show them how disgusting it was, instead of performing her own bodily functions and excretions in front of the idol, like she went and did it on the idol's head. So the priests of the idol walked up to her and they said to her, "We've never seen worship like that. Amazing." She said, "What are you talking about? You're weirdos and kinks? You're talking here about a battle between essential reality and the exact flip side, which looks to the separation and as a talent for absorbing and connecting itself exactly to the waste and the excretion." They're not a simple matter at all. And therefore, from then on, the problem becomes, and the problem is not the problem of evil, the problem is that evil cannot be discerned from good anymore. Right? And that's the issue. You know that the confusion is so deep that this illicit function of seeing the lower and the childish and the animal as desirable, instead of seeing it as that which is to be excreted, is impossible to discern. The Gemara puts it like this. Gemara says in Sukkah that the Yetzer Hara, this lower energy, has seven names. One of the names is called Tzfoni, Hatzfoni. Many meanings. One is the northern one, but the literal meaning of Tzfoni means the hidden one. So the Gemara says this Yetzer, this lower self, the childish, sensual, animalistic, perverted self, is called Tzfoni because he's hidden within you. He's hidden, that's Tzfoni. He's the one that's hidden within man's consciousness. That's what it says. You think to yourself, when I saw that Gemara the first time, I thought, I know where my Yetzer is. Maybe he's for him. If there's one thing I know, clearly I know where he is. He speaks to me all the time. He tries to pervert me. You know, I've got a very clear vision of where my Yetzer is. I don't want to say it's hidden. Any sensible person knows that he has cravings and lusts and temptations that distort his thinking. What do you mean he's hidden? So Gemara's saying something amazing here. Gemara's saying he's hidden so deeply that the one who's making that analysis is him. You know, it's like Rabbi Dessler puts it this way. He says that when man was formed originally, so his consciousness was clear, and he was only a motivation for spirituality. His total intense desire was only to bond with Hashem, namely to go back to the dimension of total objective reality. And he was tempted from a distance. That means this negative energy spoke to him from a distance in the second person, in the form of a snake. Would you like to sin? Second person. Meaning that the first person, I, was only purity, was only Kedusha. I. When he said I, his I was totally identified with God. The word ani in Hebrew means I, and it's one of God's names. When Hillel, who was the absolute pinnacle of humility, arrived in the temple, he said, Imani kan hakol kan. If I am here, everything's here. He didn't mean if I am here, he was nothing. He meant if the eye of the world is here, everything is here. So man's eye was total objective reality and was only spirituality. The second person, you, was totally distanced from the outside, speaking to him from a distance. Would you like to sin? Why would I want to do that? What could be more ridiculous? After the sin, the positions became reversed. Now the lower sensual, childish, animal, lecherous, material being is I. That's I. If you're lucky, there might be a... And it's very easy to demonstrate. If you're facing something delicious, especially that you shouldn't be eating. Which voice speaks, first or second? Or the first? I'd like to taste that. I'd like to taste that. And the conscience? You know, you shouldn't. Very humiliating. Very humiliating. And usually the tone of voice is also, I'd like to taste that, and the conscience is, excuse me. Which means that the one making the assessment now is him. It's not hidden. He's hidden so deeply. My great teacher, great Rebbe, he said, with apologies to present company, he said, what's the right way to rob a bank? You walk in with a motorcycle helmet and a gun, it's not for a Jewish boy. The way you rob a bank is you make an appointment with the manager, you walk into his room, you lock the door behind you, you put a sock in his mouth, you tie him up, you lock him up in the cupboard, you sit at his desk, you run the bank. That's a sensible way to rob a bank. That's what's been done to you by the Yetzer. He's taken over, he's making the decisions about what is and what isn't good. He's the one calling the shots. That's the degree of confusion, right? So, and why can you no longer gain clarity? The Torah says that man and woman are exiled from the garden. And as they exit and they walk out into a confused world, they can't go back. Because the gate is guarded by angels with flashing swords. is lava cherva misapeches, the blade of the sword that turns and turns and what is this? What is this creature, this angelic creature, whose sword turns and turns? Sword is a lethal weapon. And what it means is that there's a shift of consciousness that so distorts. You have a vision, you have an insight, you see the direction clearly. But you know exactly what you have to do. And you wake up the next morning, you can't believe you saw it that way yesterday. And the next day again, and that happens a few times, you can't trust your perceptions. You can't find your way back, because that clarity is not available. And from then on, man moves into a history of imagination, of setting up images that are false. And the problem is intense. The problem is that the imagination has all the power. The battle in the mind is between the original mind of spiritual purity and clarity and the lower mind of imagination. And the battle is completely unfair. Completely unfair. All the energy is on the part of the imagination. There's no strength in the intellect. There's no strength. When you sit back in an easy chair and you relax and you still your mind for a moment. Relax. Stop making an effort. Intellect doesn't function at all. Imagination functions. And imagination, there's no logic. It's an association that takes you to someplace else, and then you smell something, and then but before you know it, it usually happens when you're trying to daven a good Shemona Esrei. Now you're gonna really concentrate on every word. Before you know it, you're taking three steps back, and you've been in Hong Kong. Who knows? Sometimes you can't even remember how you got there. How do you solve a problem? You're gonna solve a difficult problem. Take an image that you need. The image may be graphic and powerful and sensual, or it may be some mathematical symbols, whatever it is. You need something. You move it to step two. Then you discard it, you call up the next image, and usually it happens before you get to step two, maybe three, some trance association sidetracks you, and it leads to a series of... And sometimes you can't even remember what the problem was you set out to solve. That's how humiliating it is. There's no logic. A powerful thinker, somebody who can discipline the imagination, he allows only the images that are necessary, completely disciplined, rides them to the next step, discards that and brings up the next image, and conquers the tendency for this to run away with you. A great artist is a small intellect riding a massive imagination. A great mathematician is a massive intellect riding small imaginary issues. They may be very, very abstract, only symbols. But it's that dance between the two that is the path to objectivity. And so that's how the world progresses. It's from one level of unreality and imagination. And the Gemara says that when a person's ill and dies, an ill person dies, the way he dies is, above his bed, he sees the angel of death, Malach HaMavis, and he's all eyes. It's all eyes. And he's holding a drawn sword, on the tip of which is a drop of poison. As the person sees him, he gasps, and he flicks the poison into his mouth. Now, there's a lot of questions to ask here. Why do you need a sword if it's poison? Yeah. Sword is a poison. But one question is, what do you mean he's all eyes? And the meaning is, because death was brought to the world by man and woman, bringing fantasy, something you see that is not real. You don't need 100 eyes to see things. The angel of death is the sudden awareness that many facets of life have been created by the vision of illusion. That's what has to die. The reason death is taking place is because those things have to dissolve. You know, when the woman, it says that it says, Vateri Haisha, man and woman were one combined male-female duality. The woman saw the fruit of the tree. You know, normally we talk in praise of Jewish women. Because normally they're the redeemers, right? Esther was a woman. She saved the Jewish people. But it's always salutary to remember that it began with a woman. Because the woman saw the fruit of the tree. And then it says, Vateri Haisha ki tova etz lemachal. The woman saw that the tree was good to eat. You can't see that a thing tastes good. You can't see that a thing tastes good. It's a complete illusion. She saw that it was good to eat. You can't do that. That's where the problem began. You see it. There's an imagination of how it will be. Or there's no logic to that. You have no experience of that. And that's where the problem began. And therefore, what now must die is all the illusory visions that have led you onto this path of living in a world of imagination. So the angel of death, that's what brought death to the world. Death means a transition into a dimension of non-existence. And that's what needs correction. You know, the Gemara says that, amazing thing, the Gemara in Chelek says that when a person sins, it says, woe to you who are drawn to sin by spider threads And woe to you who are drawn to sin by the cables that draw the carts. Right? What's called avoitos, the cables that they draw the carts with. So the Gemara on that pasuk in Nach, the Gemara says, well, what is it? Are you bound to sin by spider threads? Or are you bound to sin by cables that are unbreakable? So Gemara says, when sin begins, it attracts you with a power that is no thicker than a spider thread. After you gauge it, and you feel it, and you develop a taste, and addiction develops, then you're locked in. But he would be playing very unfair if he locked you up in a situation bound by chains, and then he said, God, I don't do that. So the initial pull to sin is a mere flick of the wrist would dissipate it. Right? She saw that the fruit was good to eat. It was a mere, nothing more than a fleeting imagination. But then engaged it. Once it's become part of you, there's no escape. Once it's, as a 13-year-old boy, he's going to try his first cigarette. What is the physiological craving for the cigarette? Zero. Is there no taste of it before? There cannot be a craving or a lust for the thing. Is that what I mean? And not only that, he smoked the first cigarette, sick for a week. Sick for a week. He's green for a day. Can't move. Sick for a week. But if 20 years later, I've been smoking 50 a day, well, you can't break it. The spider thread of tenuous imaginary. What was the attraction initially? It was only a fantasy. He's going to be the Marlboro man. That's what he's going to be. He's going to have women and horses, or horses and women, I mean. Begins with a spider's thread. Once you let it in, and it becomes part of your experience, now the I is that side. So, that's the process. You know, the Rambam says that he was asked a question. The question he was asked was this. Someone said to him that God said, if you eat the fruit of the tree, you'll be knowers of good and evil. Now you do not know good and evil. You eat the fruit of the tree, you'll be yodei tov v'ra. You'll know good and evil. And they ate the fruit of the tree, and they became knowers of good and evil. So this person said to the Rambam, that doesn't make sense, that they should gain a talent. They should gain a faculty through a sin. Before, you lack the knowledge of good and evil. Now you sin, you go against Hashem's explicit command. Now you know good and evil. So the sin led to a tremendous opening of a faculty. What does that mean? Rambam said, you misunderstand completely. Before they ate the fruit of the tree, they didn't know good and evil because all they knew was true and false. All they knew was true and false. What today we call bad was seen then as false. Today you have good and bad. What is good? As good is good, but it has a price. There's a cost. You have to limit yourself. There's certain costs to be good. Bad? Bad is bad, but has certain benefits. There's what to talk about. Like a calculation. Before that, there was only good. There was only true and false, says the Rambam. That means you saw good as true, existing, and you saw bad as false. That means to sin then and do something bad and say an unkind word to somebody or do something that betrays your own integrity wasn't something that was bad. It was something as ridiculous as convincing yourself that 1 and 1 equals 3. They didn't gain a faculty. They lost the attachment to true and false. True and false now become the calculation of good or bad. Now there's the food that you eat that has excrement within it, and the nutritious, and now it's the question. Rav Dessler says the purpose of life is to make Havdalah, is to separate. You know, it's very interesting. The food, which is the symbol for all of this, that's digested in the lower part of the body. The work of the lower part of the body is to absorb what is nourishing and to excrete that which is offensive. The middle part of the body is much more refined. Here the work is to absorb the gas that is essential, oxygen, and to excrete the gas that is bad. Much more refined, same process. And here, also, here to absorb the things that are spiritual, that are correct, that are true, that are good, and to make clear of dollar, to see things, not that it's a bad, but it has some benefit, to see clearly, but to separate that. So, that's the issue. That's the issue. The issue is having moved into a world. And Purim is exactly that. Purim is the time of Amalek, right? His power, Amalek's power, is the power of a Jewish people are called Atem Edai. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. So the ayin of the Shema is written big in the Sefer Torah, and the dalet of Echad is written big. Together they spell eight. Eight means be a witness. You witness reality. The world doesn't see it. You Jews, your function is to testify what the reality is in the world. The word aid, you rearrange the letters, it spells da, which means to know. The right kind of knowledge. Not the knowledge of the tree of the good and evil. The right knowledge, where you in this world have absorbed the knowledge of higher world. That's your function in the world. And Amalek comes along and Amalek says that the word means doubt, the gematria. Maybe not. So the battle on a simple level of national pride and anti-Semitism, the Jewish people are going through the desert, Amalek are these anti-Semites who wish to kill them. But the spiritual battle that's been fought is Jewish people are in the world to testify that this world is the emanation of the spiritual world. And Amalek is here to say, maybe not. Maybe not. Where's their point of origin? Haminites? Did you eat? Even God doesn't know. So they attack the Jewish people, even suicidally. Suicidal. Gemara says that, it says, Asher korcha baderech, who met you by the way. Amalek. Jewish people are going through the desert, and Amalek attacks. Asher korcha. Korcha has got three meanings. One is who made you cold. One is sexual immorality, carry. And one is coincidence. Happenstance. Fancy meeting you. In fact, they came from 500 miles away. The Jews weren't going anywhere near their territory. You have to understand the power of this anti-Semitism. Amalek was a nation living hundreds of miles from the path of the Jews towards Israel. The Jews had not going near the territory. So imagine now they're mounting this army to go out and attack the Jewish people in a suicidal, you know, it says, Asher korcha, they made you cold. Rashi says, like a man throws himself into a bath of boiling water. He gets badly burnt, but he cools the water. That's worth it. They're ready to attack. This is the anti-Semitism that is suicidal. Not just hating Jews because we want to get them out of the way so we can get on with what we want. But we live only to kill them, and therefore if we can't, it's worth dying for that. What's the logic of killing yourself to kill somebody else? What's the logic of that? The logic is only if he's around, my life isn't a life at all. Therefore it's worth this. So they thought, you know, Rabbi Hartman always says, imagine the general of the Amalek army. He's got the soldiers on the battlefield, and he says, right, we're going off to attack the Jews. And one soldier says, sir, is this possibly going to be a dangerous war? Yeah. Could I get killed? Yeah. Are these Jews going to attack us? No. Are there any threat to us? No. Do they have anything to do with us? No. You want me to go and risk dying in a war against the people? That's the power of anti-Semitic, and the spiritual root of it is, these Jews represent a fierce, tenacious attachment to reality, that what you don't see in the world is yet real. And Amalek's battle is the mask. Haman draws lots to decide when he's going to... So it's a lack of the happenstance, coincidence, it's when the lots happen to fall. Esther's the hidden one. Asti, I will hide my face on that day.
But didn't Amalek attack the people at the back? I mean, the old people.
Yeah, yes, no. And they got nearly wiped out. They chose the point of attack was the weak and the stragglers. Right? And Yeshua battled them. And they were almost decimated. Almost. As long as Moshe Rabbeinu's hands were up, we won the battle. They only just survived. In fact, the Jewish people were given another chance to wipe them out later. Saul was commanded to wipe them out. In simple terms, it means these are people who hate you, they try to kill you, you have to kill them in an act of survival. In spiritual terms, these are the people who introduce a gap in the world and declare that the world is not an emanation of a spiritual source. And your work in the world is to eliminate that gap. That's what Jews are for. You know, the work of a witness is to bring the incident into the courtroom. In Jewish law, the witness has to bring the incident into the courtroom. Not to reconstruct it. For example, in Jewish law, if witnesses come to court to testify that they heard somebody cursing blasphemy, right? They're not allowed to tell the court that he did it. They have to say what he said again, reconstruct it, and the law is the judges empty the court. The only people who remain in the courtroom are the judges who need to hear it. They stand. The witnesses repeat what was said and the judges tear their clothing. That's the din. You don't tell them that it happened. They've got to reconstruct it, bring it into the courtroom. Right? That's what you Jews are in the world for.
So, can we go back to the reference you just made to Saul?
Yeah.
Do you not find it troubling that Saul's sin was to fail to commit
genocide? His command was to wipe out Amalek. This is like your question is like, imagine you have a battalion of Hitlers approaching you and you have an opportunity to wipe them out. And your Jewish sensitivity is, that's not decent. And that's what happened. What happened was Saul was commanded to wipe them out. Every vestige, men, women, children, animals, everything. We're talking about eliminating from the world the gap, the imminence of spirituality in the world. That's what we mean here. And he took your line of thinking. One man, Agag, I'm the king, he's the king. And he lost the kingship because of that. Not only that, the next morning when Amalek was still alive, Agag was still alive. Agag was the forebear of Haman. Shmuel arrived, Samuel the prophet. God told you to kill him. Saul said, well, so he killed him on the spot. Shmuel killed him on the spot. But the Medrash says that he had been with a woman during the night, and she was pregnant, and the seed of Amalek survived, and out of that was born Haman, who was the ultimate genocidal plot to kill the Jewish people. The whole Jewish people on one day.
Still raises it still raises as a justified action.
This is what God told him. God,
that if so commanded, you should kill everybody, women, children.
That's
there
what
are
God.
Races that deserve to be eliminated.
Just Amalek.
Well,
just Amalek. Amalek is only.
But it raises the possibility that it's justified to kill an entire nation.
It absolutely does not. Absolutely does not. It raises the possibility that when God commands you to wipe out Amalek, which we can't do nowadays, you'd have an obligation to do that. That would cure the world's problems. You're talking about God here, not what you and I think is decent. Right? When God told him to kill his own child, told Abraham to kill his own son, no less ridiculous than that. Right? So, the applications of this in the world are as evil as you can imagine, right? What this is extended to. But that's the nature of the battle. And it raised its head again as a consequence of this, as a Haman, who foisted on the world a plan to kill all Jews on one day. You're talking about complete genocide. That's the power we're talking about here. But be that as it may, the original problem here is the problem of perception, the problem of imagination, distortion. Rabbi Shaul Salanter, in his classic work, the first line of his classic Musa work, which is the work of character building and his introductory line is, he says that we are free in our imagination and bound in our intellect. Adam chavshi b'dimyono, man is free in his imagination, v'asur b'muskaloi, and he's bound in his intellect. Which means intellect is always bound. The truth is always constrained. Falsehood is always unlimited. How many correct answers are there to a mathematical problem? Perhaps one. How many wrong answers? As many as you want. And therefore, the truth is always constrained. Intellectual discipline, right? By the way, as a complete aside, in Jewish educational policy, this is one of the reasons why discipline for children is extremely important. It isn't only good for character. Discipline is also essential for intellectual development. Because a powerful thinker can think laterally, break rules, think outside the box, extremely creatively, but always in parts that are true. And therefore, it requires discipline, no matter how creative and how multifarious multiplex the thinking can be, but it always has to be in parts that are true. And therefore, he says that in your imagination, you're completely free. Imagination completely unconstrained. You can dream things that are completely mutually exclusive and impossible. No problem at all. It doesn't even bother you in a dream. Dreams, by the way, are an entry into the world of unreality, into the world of death. The Gemara says dream is a 60th of death. Sleep is a 60th of death. And dreams are 60th of the prophetic world. Access to both sides. But That's the thing. What's the correction for this? The correction should be obvious. But the process of correction here is a fierce determination to see things as they are, to attach to objective reality. How do you do that? One is a brutally honest decision to remain attached to objectivity and not to the childishness of the distorted thinking. The two tools we have in Jewish life for that, we have two tools. One is learning Torah, and one is Asay L'Charav, get yourself a teacher. But learning Torah, you know that the yeshiva world has adopted the practice of studying the Babylonian Talmud virtually exclusively. The exercise of studying the Babylonian Talmud is an exercise in developing objective vision. Talmud Bavli, the word Babylonian, the Babylonian Talmud, is that when clarity broke down and we moved into the phase of the oral law, the Kabbalists explained that when reality broke, all you have is broken shards of the truth, fragments. And if you want to reconstruct the truth when you have no direct access to it, all you can use is the mistaken notions, and by reconstructing them, you might gain truth. How anyone has learned Talmud knows. The Talmud never presents a solution. The Talmud produces wrong. How does the Talmud work? It spends three pages proving you a certain thesis, elegantly, and then shows you why it's wrong. It's called a Havamina and a Maskana. A very elegant proof of a whole thesis that turns out then to be wrong. And by perceiving how it's wrong, you get to something deeper. Then you re-examine that, and it looks much more cogent, then you see where that's wrong. There's a training in not accepting things at face value. There's no mathematics textbook that spends 3 pages proving your thesis and then shows you fooled you. The Talmud only gets, the Kabbalists explain Talmud Bavli, the word Bavel, the English word Babel, is cognate to this. Bavel is the place where language broke down. Talmud Bavli is an exercise. And that's why in Jerusalem Talmud, which is much higher, and Zohar, when they want to show you a thesis, they always introduce it by the words Tachazi, come and see. The Babylonian Talmud always introduces the word Tashma. Tashma, me, come and hear. Here's always a reconstruction that is subjective in the darkness. Seeing, you see the way it is. That's why seeing is believing, they say. Right? The witness has to see. Hearing happens in the darkness. Seeing, you see it objectively. It's all there. Hearing is your personal construction. You hear one syllable, then the next. And by the time the person gets to the end of the sentence, you still don't know what he's talking about. And when he says the final word, then you reconstruct the whole thing. The word shama in Hebrew means to assemble parts. To hear means to assemble. Vayishama Shaul et ha'am. It says Saul gathered the people together. It says shama. Hearing, the faculty of hearing, means assembling the parts and making sense of them. By the way, when you say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, we say, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is God, the Lord is one. Shema Yisrael. People think it means, Hear, O Israel. Why? That's important. The rest of the Torah is not so important. This is important. You can sleep with the rest of it. Now you need to wake up. Ridiculous. Every word of Torah is essential. Shema doesn't mean, listen, this is important. Shema means learn how to make Echad. Learn how to take a fractured, differentiated, particulate world and assemble it into a oneness. That's what Shema means. Shema is Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. There's oneness here. Even though it appears to be a disparate, broken down series. And that's what Talmud, the exercise of Talmudic study. The Talmud does not bring you to correct conclusions. Very seldom does the Talmud even give you a conclusion. You want the conclusion, you don't look in the Talmud, you look in the Code of Jewish Law. The Talmud is there to teach you how to think, how to take broken down aspects of reality that falsely present themselves as truth and perceive where they're wrong. There are no access. The world is a confused world now. You cannot isolate and select elements of truth. So you take the false world, and you reconstruct it. That's one tool. And finally, the other tool is to have a rabbi. You need a spiritual teacher, and you're looking for somebody who's more mature than you, who's more objective than you, who's not afraid to tell you the truth about yourself. And in the yeshiva tradition, we're looking for teachers who are brutal. Brutal. Today, you tell a student what's wrong with him, he runs off looking for somebody who's going to stroke his ego. Well, you never get anywhere that way. You want a teacher who is brutal. If you study martial arts, you study martial arts? You want a teacher. You don't want a teacher who says you're doing fine. You want a teacher who breaks your jaw. It might save your life one day. Is that right? You want a teacher who says you're doing fine. We look in the yeshiva world, we look for teachers. My teacher, one of the great rabbinic thinkers of this generation, I've heard him say things to people I don't think I would have survived. Once in a class, a fellow asked a question. He said to him, that question's not even stupid. A few minutes later, the guy asked another question. He said to him, that's already stupid. The guy was Israeli, so it didn't bother him. But you know, I mean, the point is that you're looking you want to be opened. Right? And therefore, they used to hire. Do you know that today people hire people, sycophants? They walk around with a team and say, gee, boss, you're great, and that was funny, and tell us the joke again. They used to hire people to criticize. The marshal, one of the great rabbis, he hired a man to be mochiachim. His job was to walk around and criticize him. You wake up in the morning and say, late again! If you're serious, it's a wife's job, by the way. It's a wife's job. A woman has to know how to do it, of course. You can't tell a man he's wrong. You have to make a man think he thought of it himself. You have to know how to handle men. But that's the goal. And therefore, in summary, what we study today, Purim is the time of the masked world. Adar is the time of confusion. It's the time of, in Kabbalah, Adar is the month of laughter. You know, every month of the 12 has a different faculty. Pesach, Nisan is speaking. Pesach, the mouth talks. Every month. Adar is laughter. It's the spleen. Which part of the body? Spleen. And laughter. What is laughter? Laughter is the response to incongruity, which looks impossible, and suddenly there's an explosion where you see exactly. There's a transition from the confusion to a clarity. It's there. Right? A woman of greatness laughs at the day of death. She laughs at the day of death. That means when the correction finally manifests, is hilarity of laughter. The Jewish people are born from a child called Yitzchak, which means he will laugh. Because his mother's too old, his father's too old, they can't possibly have a child, and God says he'll have a child. It's laughter. And when he's old enough to have children and get married, Hashem says, kill him. It's a black comedy, you understand? And he takes the knife and is about to kill him, and the Chumash says he survives, and the Zohar says he was burnt. His ashes remain on the altar. Is that impossible? Yeah. That's very funny, that this act of killing him generates a human being who's going to survive all of history, even though most of the world trying to kill him. The Zohar says, Yitzchak spells Kate Schai, death in life. That means he walks in the next world while his feet are in this one. Yitzchak means he will laugh. Jewish history is no laughing matter. We're talking about the last laugh. But it's a set, and that's the hilarity of Purim. Purim is the masked world, and it's the understanding that there's something deeper that moves here, even though it's not apparent on the surface. And the world moves through dimensions of imagination, right? Thicker and darker, but more and more brutal and chaotic, all built on figments of imagination. And the work here is to see, right, the reality that moves beneath the surface. Okay.